Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 100-Year Real Estate Investor. We're your host, Jake and Gino, and this is the show dedicated to long-term personal financial engineering. Gino, how's it going? Looking sharp today. Looking good.
I was just going to say, I got dressed up for you, and you're making fun of me. So that's okay. Do I look good for
you
today?
You don't understand the difference between a true compliment from a friend and making fun of you. So we're going to work on that after the show. But we have a very special guest today, so we do not want to delay. Our guest today is the CEO and founder of NNG. He has over 23 years of experience in residential and commercial real estate, and he's created strong passive income flows that attract investors from all over the globe. We're thrilled to have him here, and we're going to discuss his journey as an entrepreneur and real estate investor. So without further ado, Fuquan Bilal, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys. Really appreciate it. I watch your podcast. It's a plum pleasing pleasure to be here with you guys. So,
dude, you know, we got another alliteration junkie. So we're gonna fit right in here. That's fantastic. So let's get right into it. Let's hear a little bit about your story and how you got started in the business.
Yeah, I mean, so in '99, I kind of jumped out the window and grew wings falling down, so to speak, as Les Brown always say. I worked in corporate, and a cousin of mine, we've always been like rivalry since we was younger, who's making the most money. And at the time I was a young kid making $80,000-$85,000 a year in sales. And he did his first real estate deal within less than 6 months of being in business, made half my salary, showed off the paycheck to me. I was a little jealous. So I started to shadow him around for the next couple of months. And I too was able to make that paycheck. And I immediately put my 2-week notice in. And from there, I've been on a real estate journey since '99. And I would say after I made that first paycheck, because I did not grow up with financial freedom, with financial literacy, right? I blew the whole paycheck in less than probably 3 months, you know, with the fancy cars, the materialistic stuff and everything else. And very quickly learned the lesson that this is a transactional. Is not something that, like a job, you have a steady paycheck, you can rely on it getting every week, every 2 weeks, but it was something that I wanted to conquer. So I quickly started to realize that I needed the budget and become more smart in what I was doing.
We had conquer being less transactional, just to be clear. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah. What can I do to set up where I can have maybe income streams coming in?
Reoccurring revenue streams.
Absolutely. Yeah. I didn't learn that until the market crashed because I was, a junkie really to those big chunks of cash when we flip property. So I would say from 99.
Transaction junkie, Gino, you're going to have a field day here.
I would need it my hit. Where's the next hit coming from? So probably from 99, back then it was an FHA market, right? The subprime market didn't hit yet in 99. It was there, but you know, in areas where I was investing, it was pretty much usury. It was, you know, 12, 14%. They were redlining certain areas. I'm from Newark, New Jersey, so it's like the hood area. And that's kind of where I went back first to redevelop the properties because there were a lot of blighted properties, a lot of burnouts, fire damage stuff. And it gave me the feeling of importance to be able to go back to my community and put the cape on my back and go in and fix these houses and hire people from the community and go through that whole process. But it was tough to get certain loans. So FHA was prominent, and we did a lot of those loans and helped people get houses. And I learned the market that way. The unfortunate part that I made a big mistake on was really trusting the people in the community where I grew up at, giving them work. Most of these guys did demolition work, and it was an inside job, and we were set up for payroll robbery. And basically, I was shot 5 times, you know, in that botched robbery. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me because it really taught me the importance of the people in your circle. And really how to separate yourself. Even though you want to do an impact, you can do it from a distance. You don't need to be boots on the ground.
Fuquan, let's dive into that though, real quick. You just said you got shot 5 times and you
and glossed, just breeze right past and kept going. That
really quick.
It's the best thing that happened to me.
Was it a pellet gun or did you get real shot? Like, because that's a big deal, dude.
9mm bullets.
Yeah. So the best thing that ever happened to me was probably meeting Jake and marrying my wife, then Jake. I don't have getting shot top 5. Why was it the best thing that ever happened to you?
Because I think as most people, we don't really appreciate the value of life. And at that point, I appreciated the small things like being able to tie my shoes because I had staples in my stomach and I couldn't tie my shoe. I couldn't use the bathroom. I had to take a repository, whatever that thing is that, you know, helps you use the bathroom. And you know, just I didn't have kids at the time. So for me, it was very tough not being married or not having a family or connected. That was like, wow, if I would have been gone, what would I have left behind? Nothing.
Right. And what did you grow? How were you able to get back on your feet and start the business after that?
Yeah, what percentage of people live from five gunshots too? Like, this is a big deal, dude.
Well, you got 50 Cent. He lived five gunshots.
He's a little thicker than you, dude.
So for me, I was able to go inward, right? I was able to have time to myself, disconnected from everything, and have a lot of thought and go inward. And I think that most people don't spend that time with themselves on a daily basis to think, to process, to journal, to kind of recap and then make a move. It's easier to do than to think. Mm-hmm. So most people just do. So it taught me really how to think things out. And I had a lot of time with myself to kind of figure out what direction I'm going to go and really plan ahead, you know, family, the people in my circle, how I want to get laser focused on business. And I see it as the best thing that ever happened to me, because that happened March 30th of 2001. And I was only in the business for a few years before that happened. But from March to December, I sold 36 houses. And I was really, it took me 6 months to recuperate. But during that time, I had so much time with myself, it kind of helped me grow faster as individually. Because I always think your business will never grow to the extent that, would only grow to the extent that you do. So now that I have more time to go inward and fix some things I had going on with myself, my business was able to grow as well. So that's why I said it's the best thing that ever happened to me.
So when you do that and you're doing great and it's 2008 and you hit another wall, you didn't get shot five times, but it must have been a real shock to you. What did you learn from the 2008 recession?
Well, that was the second best thing that ever happened to me. And then my divorce was the third best thing that ever happened to me, which
Jake is fun, dude, like a little pain in his life. You know what I'm saying? You're getting shot at, you're getting divorced, you're getting hammered at the Great Recession. Yeah, I want to know the bad things. What are the worst things that ever happened to you? That's the best.
2008, I lost $2 million in my own money. And I said that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because if you go back to what I was saying earlier, I did not have passive cash flow. I was a adrenaline junkie, was the next deal, flipping, flipping, flipping. And I didn't really understand, because back then the spread on a rental property was $300, $400 a month. And I was like, why do I want to go through all this work doing construction just to collect $300 a month? Like, that's stupid. I can make $60,000 right now if I sell this property. Why would I do that? My mindset wasn't there on appreciation, depreciation from, you know, for taxes. And building up those income streams for the future and eventually paying down that principal and having this nest egg of properties that I can leverage later on and buy more properties free, clear debt. So I wasn't at that level of maturity yet in the business. I just transitioned from corporate. Growing up where I grew up at, there was no financial literacy taught. So for me, making $60,000, $40,000 a pop was like, you know, I made it. I was a millionaire when I was 28. And basically by the time 2008 came around, I lost $2 million. I paid off my investors. And that was the best thing that happened to me, because it taught me how to be a landlord. It forced me to be a landlord. And it also forced me to look into other parts of real estate, which was the note business. Around 2010, after picking my face up from the ground and going through a divorce and everything else, I started to learn about the note business. In 2011, I started to invest my own money over those next couple of years. In 2013, I was able to open up a fund. Because during that transition between 2010 and 2013, at the time, my 8-year-old son in 2010 had heard me on the phone arguing with a short sale negotiator, because at that time in the market, that was prominent, short sales. And he goes, why are you arguing with the bank? Why don't you just become the bank? And I was like, this is impossible to be the bank. Dad, you said anything is possible. And I'm like, oh, yeah, everything is possible.
Eat your own words, Pops.
So I had to research, and I started to research, and I saw that a fund is pretty much essentially like your own bank, right? So how do you set up a fund? I started researching. There's a bunch of companies that do it all turnkey ready for you. And I said, no, I'm not going to go that route. So I spoke with an SEC attorney and learned that whole process and how it works. And $35,000 later, that's the cost to set up my first PPM. I had a fund in 2013 and started to learn now how do you really be successful at being fund management? What are the KPIs you need to manage? You know, how do you raise capital? That's a whole other business. you know, besides, you know, the processes you need for fix and flips and rentals. So it took me years really to learn that, and I'm still learning, but I'm on my sixth fund now, and I'm grateful that 2008 happened because it kind of forced me to do something else and learn another skill set that no one that I know from my community where I grew up at is a fund manager.
So for the listeners out there, I don't want them to have to go out and get shot. I don't want to have them to go out and lose $2 million to learn the principles.
It can be easier than that.
Yes. And it's right. That smart people learn from their mistakes. Jake, Gino, and Fuquan are real smart because we made some pretty big mistakes we've learned. Wise people learn from others' mistakes. That's why you listen to podcasts like this. You may have to go through those trials and tribulations, but I don't think you have to, because if you listen to Fuquan's words, those are words of pain. Being shot not once, five times. Losing $2 million in 2008 when you're in your mid to late 20s is a significant amount of capital. I've lost money. I haven't lost that much, but I've lost money. And when you're looking at it, it really comes down to the long-term mindset. Look behind me. It's the 100-year real estate investor. It's all about long-termism. And when did that light bulb, were you able to convince yourself that it's not just a $300 spread? It's that, hey, you can refi these properties out, pull the money out, and put it into the next deal. When did that light bulb go off? When did you say to yourself, man, I'm really leaving too much on the table? And the $60,000 really isn't 60 because I got to pay taxes on that 60. And then when I get that 40, I'm going to go out and spend that on a vacation.
And that's
for
it.
A luxury.
And it's no more fun. That's it. It's a one-time rip and I'm done. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would say the light bulb went off when I changed my circle and I started to hang around wiser people and people that was in a business long enough. And they started to educate me and say, hey, I want a portfolio of 100 properties. Now that $300-$400 a month makes sense on 100 properties or whatever amount of doors you have. And then, like you just said, the taxes and then the depreciation you can take advantage of and all this. I didn't understand that part of the business. So when I learned it, I go, oh, and I kind of learned that when I got into the note business, because the note business, we were buying, what we still do today, buy delinquent debt from the banks or servicers. And then we buy it at a huge discount because it's delinquent, we reperform it, right? So just case in point, we buy second mortgages, which is really an oddball. But what happens is we buy second mortgages behind performing first. So the average balance is $50,000 on a house that's worth $350,000. Maybe they got a first on it for X amount. Now, if I buy that $50,000 worth of debt for, you know, back then we were getting it for 10 cents on a dollar. So, of course,
are these like HELOCs or are these like seller finance notes?
They were HELOCs and also purchase money mortgages, whatever, if they were like the first and second back then. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, they're more HELOCs, but we were able to, pricing is significantly higher now. But back then, when I first got in, it was 10 cents on a dollar. So I was buying a $50,000 loan for $5,000. And a homeowner didn't know what I paid for it. So I would have that difference of what they owe versus what I paid for it. I would be able to lower their payment, keep the principal, but lower their payment. And once I had to perform, I can now sell that asset for maybe a 15% return. Maybe that calculated out to selling it for $20,000.
How would you lower the payment? You lower the rate, extend the AM? Like what are you doing there?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I would give them a 30-year, lower the rate, and then I would extend the payments out. The goal was to be able to give a return to, if an investor bought it for $25,000, they would make a 15% return based on the monthly payment they're receiving, right? So that's kind of how I set it up. And then they can resell it to somebody higher that wanted a 10% return. So I was structured where there was still meat on the bone, where I can sell it and they can sell it for more if they needed to exit it. And 10% back then, it was amazing for a lot of people. So that's how we would structure it. We would buy it at a discount, or we would do discounted payrolls. We would call the homeowner and go, hey, you owe us 50, just give us 10, we'll eliminate the debt. And we made 100% return on our money if we paid $5,000 for it. So when I started to learn that part of the business, I understood once I start reperforming notes that those small payments matter. Those $300 a month, those $400 a month. And now my goal was to get as many of those as I could. And that's what brought me back to the real estate and go, oh, if I get a rental property now, if I'm making a $300, $400 spread, then that's great. And the bigger I get the discount, the more return I can make. The discount on the acquisition, the more I can manage construction. The rents were going up for top quality units. Then I can kind of make a better return. So learning the note business, the fix and flip business, and also the rental business, it's really gave me a lot of great opportunities and a lot of different ways I can pivot in the market, especially in today's market.
What's the business look like now? You're still doing notes. You're more into multifamily. Tell us what you're doing these days.
More into multifamily. It kind of went down. So a fund I launched, I would say maybe 3 years ago now, it was to buy the strategy notes because we still have relationship with the banks and servicers. It was to also buy some tax liens because we were able to tap into a few communities to get tax liens on vacant properties. And those were transitioned to fix and flips. So tax lien was the strategy for the acquisition. Then we would get it, we would fix it, then we would sell it or rent it. And then it became that, and then rentals also. So having that diverse strategy allowed us to be able to deploy the capital to buy notes, to buy tax liens, to buy rentals. And we had process systems and a team to manage that, but we wasn't sitting on capital. We had an opportunity in each area, we can deploy the capital and manage it. Today is more just two-prong approach, whereas this fix and flips in New Jersey, where I've been investing the last 24 years, and multifamily in the Southeast. So after COVID, we had a huge migration of buyers from New York come in, and it gave me the opportunity to sell off all of the smaller multifamilies, the two units, the three units, the six units, because I would look at that, and New Jersey is pretty much pro-tenant, and we learned that like during COVID. All the rules and everything were for them. And I was like, oh, we need to go to the red states, you know, Southeast region.
Dude, my uncle got beat up like 20 years ago over some lead paint shit. And it was brutal on him. Yeah, it was tough.
It's crazy. So we saw that it was more pro-tenant. And fortunately, 85% of our portfolio during COVID was Section 8, battered women and children. That's part of, you know, our goal for our company is still giving back to the community where, like, the areas where I came up and going in and revitalizing those areas. Like I mentioned earlier, that gave me the feeling of importance to be able to go into the hood, so to speak, revitalize the property, Class C area, put it back on the tax rolls for the township benefits, give the residents a better place to live, and invest in one because the income is great on it. So we're looking at all these properties, over 100 different properties. I think it was maybe 160 doors or something like that, if not maybe some more than that. COVID gave us the opportunity to divest that portfolio, build a war chest, and then take that money and go start investing in bigger properties in the Southeast, where we have 100 unit in one place versus, you know, multiple properties, and you got to shovel snow and all the logistics for that was crazy. So today, the answer to your question, strategy is Southeast region. Pretty much we're going deep in Alabama and Georgia, and we're still doing fix and flip for the huge liquidity points in New Jersey.
Is that through a fund or general syndications?
Correct.
Fund model for the apartments?
So it's a fund that makes the acquisitions, but we have a syndication which becomes a sidecar. So for example, we just closed on 120 unit in Macon, Georgia.
And oh, Bill Hamm, his ears just perked up. We got a guy on our team who's from Macon.
We have the 140 unit, which is a sister property under contract now. We'll be closing that once they get 90-for-90 season and on the leases, because we need to be 92 or 93% occupied to get permanent financing. So they had 20 down units, which in our contract, they had to get those rent ready and get them leased up to occupancy to get permanent financing. So that they're working on that. We'll be closing on that probably in 3 months or less. But we set that 120 unit up in a syndication, but we had the fund as the GP, and it's a 30% partner in that syndication. So we put up a million of the four we had to raise. We became a 30% partner. We gave investors 70% share, 8% pref, quarterly distributions, and it's already cash flowing. So we have the fund who sidecar with the syndication that we own and becomes the GP, and that way, if we want to do four, if we instead of taking $4 million and putting that up as the 40%, whatever, if we're getting 60% leverage, we now can do four deals like that if we do a million a piece and raise the rest of the capital from the investors versus one deal, if that makes sense.
It does. Fuquan, right. I got a tough question for you.
Sure.
I see that you've done, I don't want to say dozens of strategies. Jake and I are pretty boring. We've picked multifamily. We didn't have the shiny object syndrome. We tried to figure it out from the very beginning. You've done a lot of really great strategies. You've done tax liens. You've done short sales. You've done fix and flips. You've done Section 8. would it have been easier for you to just to say, hey, let me get into multifamily from the very beginning? Or was it still you were younger and just trying to figure things out and you were jumping to the next shiny object and going, oh, because I'm going to tell you right now, what you're doing right now with the fund and with multifamily, that's going to revolutionize your investors, your business life. But did you need that? Did you need to get shot five times? Did you need to lose $2 million? Did you need to do all those different
things? I hope not. Right now?
No. So true story. The same son, he's 20 years old now, who asked me when he was eight, why don't you just become the bank? In 2019, we were sitting out and he got his real estate license. He was excited. He was in 11th grade and he, you know, passed the school test and he was waiting to turn 18 to take a state test. And he goes, you know, I don't think I want to be involved in a fix and flip. It's too much work with these contractors and everything else. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, you taught me that you said that the best thing that ever happened was cash flow from rentals. He goes, I have a question for you. Why are you not doing a big apartment building multifamilies? Why are you buying these little two family, three families, and you're dealing with all of that stuff?
Yeah, it seems like a parable, but the son is the wise one, and he just keeps asking the questions to the dad. Right? You got to write this book, dude.
Yeah.
And then my son came to me and he told me, what are you doing, dude?
That's literally how it was.
I said, we got to buy apartments, son. This is crazy.
5:30 in the morning, because he stays up all night, right? Video game head, stays up all night and sleeps all day. This was when COVID was happening. He had asked me this question. No, it was 2020, actually, he asked me this question. No, in 2019, before COVID. We were sitting in the backyard, 5:30 in the morning. I get up early, super early. He's out in the backyard. I'm like, what are you doing? I'm just thinking, okay, I guess he was going through girl problems, whatever, he couldn't sleep. That's what I put it to. So we're talking, and he asked me the question. I start to think, yeah, why am I not doing that? Why am I? He's like, I think you're playing too small. And I was like,
Dude, that hurts coming from your son. Holy shit.
It was awakening, though. I was like, he was
right.
So dude, my son never tells me that. 2019, I started to really look at the multifamily stuff, and I had to decide which market I want to go into. And at first, I was like, Ohio. I'm going to go to Ohio because things were dirt cheap there and I can buy up everything. And it's one of those communities like where I come from and in Cleveland, and I can go there and make a difference. And I flew out to Ohio and started looking at stuff. And I was like, wow, this is not where I want to be. This is not, you know, it has to be something better. And I started to research and I went back to where do we have the most relationships at for my note business? Where do we had boots on the ground, realtors, attorneys and everything else. And I pinpointed the Southeast region is where we have most of our resources. I have family in Atlanta. So I started to go down there and investigate in 2019. And I started to, you know, watch podcasts and do a lot of stuff and just started to create those relationships. And it just grew from there. Mm-hmm. And we purchased our first 95 unit in 2021. It was July, I think it was March or April 2021. We purchased a 95 unit by Birmingham. And then it just snowballed from there. We purchased a 64 unit. We closed 240 units. We just closed on 120 units. So it's starting to grow. And I'm glad that I picked the Southeast because there's a lot of great opportunities down there. And yeah, that's kind of how I transitioned to answer your question, just into multifamily. But we're keeping that fix and flip because now it's like a cookie cutter. I've been doing it all these years and I have all these resources and relationships in these towns. It's I'm comfortable with doing it. That was the answer I gave my son. I guess I never went out of my zone because went to do that because I'm comfortable with what I'm doing and I never challenged myself or think that I will be able to close on a $30 million building.
Yes. You know? And Fuquan, let me jump in. Jake, before you ask the next question, I want to share a story real quick. The other day with my son, I have the opposite problem that you have. I'm singing opera and I'm warming up with him. And I'm getting, my range is pretty high. I'm a dramatic tenor. I can hit the low F and I can go up to a high A right now. So I'm warming up. I hit the A and it's not crystal clear. It's not 100%, about 92% of the way there. I'm like, bro, let's go to the B flat. He's like, dad, I don't think you should do that. You can hurt your voice. And I know hopefully my wife's not listening to the podcast. I said, fuck that. I said, hit the B flat. We're going. If I lose my voice, it's okay. I'm going to lose on my time. We're not playing small here, bro. I'm coming at you, right? And
wow. He's like,
and then he hit the B flat, and I hit the B flat. And it takes about 3 months to keep going up. By the end of 2023, I will be hitting a C. I will promise everybody that. And it's all about challenging yourself. And he's actually got a better range than I do. And I'm not doing it to challenge him or to actually compete against him.
Yes, you are. You're afraid the young pup's going to take over the house here.
Well, that's what I'm saying, bro.
You got to put him down, Gino. You got to show who's boss, bro.
As a male, I'm competing against myself. And I think Fuquan is doing the same thing.
Keep telling yourself that.
Dude, I am. But you know what? I want to get better and better every day. Like Fuquan was saying, he was too comfortable. I don't want to be comfortable hitting an F or a G or an A. I want to challenge myself and see if I can hit the B flat. And that's the thing. And Jake, I'll give you another quick story. You may be right about that because my daughter comes to me the other day and she goes, "Hey, Dad, do you want to play chess?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I don't really know." She goes, "I'll go easy on you." And I'm like, "Bro, game on, broad." I say, "You're going to go easy on me? I'm gonna crush you, right?"
Yeah.
Seven moves later, she does this Vienna Gambit or whatever the hell. She wipes me. She cleans my clock. I'm like, "I'm done. I'm not playing anymore." So you may have some truth
to
that.
You quit. No, I'd be like, line it up again.
Dude, she crushed me. No, because they're practicing right now. So they're getting ready and stuff. She had me, dude, I had no shot. Like literally six moves. I had all my pieces up, ready to go. And she goes, "Checkmate." I'm like, what a loser I am. So the moral of those stories
They're coming for you.
Get out of your comfort zone. I mean, if you've got your children saying that you're playing too small, you know there's something going on. You need to really step it up. You need your kids to say to you, "Dad, you're doing a good job. You may hurt yourself. Watch out."
They've always been involved in my real estate career one way or another. And when Jake actually, before we started recording, he said, How you doing? I told him, "Better and better." And that's what I say when people ask me how I'm doing, constantly remind myself. But I've always had my children involved in the real estate. And it's a way when they ask me, you know, how can they make money? Because in my house, it's not, "Dad, do you have $20? It's how can I make $20, right? That mindset. So I would take them out and go, "Hey, I need you to go record this video of the walkthrough I'm going to do because I need to show investors where I'm at in the stage of the renovation. I'm going to pay you to record the video." And I would purposely bring them so they can hear me talking to the contractors, talking to different people, and they learn that way. And then I go, "Hey, now I'm going to give you $15 to edit it. And I just need you to edit me a 5-minute video and you make $35. And, you know, that's that." And they were younger then when they were doing that. So they learned the software, learned how to edit. And they kept playing it over and over and learned certain things. Okay, now we're going to do an educational series on what is a realtor? How does a lawyer play a part in a real estate transaction? What is this? How is a title company? And that was me teaching them and creating these little videos that I could put on my Instagram or TikTok or whatever. And they learned through that way. So that was a way of me, and I would take that money and have them do the IRA account and all the other stuff. So that was a way of me teaching my kids and planting seeds. My oldest, he's more into computers, so he's going to school now for cybersecurity, just got a certification in that. He got into real estate, and he was like, "It's too much work for me. These contractors, I don't feel like dealing with it." But my youngest, he swears he's going to follow my footsteps and, you know, be into real estate. But he said, "I want to be a lender. I don't want to be the guy fixing and flipping houses. I need you to really teach me the lending part. That's the part I want to master." I'm like, "Okay, smarter than me." Awesome.
Give me some predictions here. Where are we at in the market cycle? Where's the economy headed? Are we at the bottom? Are you a Goldilocks kind of guy? Are we coming out of this, or are we going to be in the trenches?
No, I think we have about another 24 months of hell. I think Q4 of 2024, we'll see some transitions to interest rates dropping. We all know rates are going to be increased. So we are preparing internally to, I don't want to use the word suffer, but to go through what we're going to go through for the next 24 months. So right now in Q1, of course, the first thing we're focusing on is K-1s to get that the hell out of the way and 1099s and refining our processes and systems. So those are our rocks and deliverables for Q1. So we're laser focused on that. Q2 basically is we actually gone through some internal stuff with our team. So we, as I mentioned earlier, your business will only grow to the extent that you do. So now we're spending this first quarter empowering our team, right? We have these weekly calls where we're going through, different presentations, and we're watching them, and we're learning on how to communicate with each other, how to delegate responsibility, how to give feedback in an objective manner to receive it. So we're going through all of that because we know we're going to go through these transitions. And while we're doing that internally, we know how the market is changing externally, right? We want more blood in the street. We want to see more stuff sitting on the market longer so sellers, you know, understand that they need to
start. He's talking about cheap deals and not bullets though, folks. All right, just to be clear.
Great deals, not good deals is what we're looking for. So we're only going to make acquisitions during these next 2 years if they're great deals. And we believe if there's enough blood in the street that will happen. But right now we're retooling internally to get prepared for whatever is to come so we can, you know, we're scaling to be better, not bigger, so to speak. So we're working on us internally as people, and then process systems and everything else.
Buquan, last question for me, Jake, real quick. For me, as you're transitioning, you're looking at this from the long-term mindset, give me one or two things that you've done to help build that enduring organization. You've talked about your weekly calls. You talked about, it sounds as if you're doing your rocks, traction. What have you done to really consider yourself to be building that enduring organization?
The culture is the foundation of everything. Really laser focusing on culture. We actually made, so our core values are performance, accountability, transparency, and success. And success is that daily optimized experience sustainable over time. So we're doing people analyzer once a month. It's an EOS tool you guys can use if you guys are hit with EOS, the listeners. We'll be doing people analyzers instead of once a quarter. We're doing it once a month, and we're seeing if our team are in alignment with our core values. The team manager is doing that with their team individually, so we can help them grow and make sure that we have the right button, the right seats consistently. And we're making sure that, you know, if they're meeting that performance, accountability, transparency, if they're in alignment with those core values, are they having success? And we believe if they have those three core values in line, then they will have that daily optimized experience. And that brings the culture, the fun to come to work, excited to come to work, wanting to share and learn. And really, those quarterly meetings are helping also, making each department understand how they intertwine and how they benefit each other. And we're not having silos. So we're working together as a team. So that's kind of what we're focused on. I think that's going to help us continue to grow. And as far as the 100-year goal, we look at it, of course, 10 years, 3 years, 1 year, and then we break that down to quarterly rocks. But the BHAG is 5,000 doors in 10 years. And then we just reverse engineer to see how do we get to that level to get there. That makes sense.
Yes.
It is crystal clear. Two metrics here. What is the rate, the interest rate on the deal that you're currently doing, and the price per unit, just because I love talking shop and curious.
When I just closed, was we got a 5.48 long-term. Colliers was the lender. When I got the approval, it was a 4.2, but the 10-year was really close, 3.7 something or whatever when we closed. So we closed on that. I just got pricing now where we are.
Your rate was 5.48, you're saying?
5.48 was the rate that I got on that. And we got 55% leverage. When I got the first approval, it was 65% leverage at a 4.2. And as we got closer to closing, the 10-year jumped. And by the time we closed on it, it was 5.48 with 55% leverage. So I had to get back on a bike and raise another $1 million to close the deal. So the next deal now, the one that we're waiting for 90 for 90, I just got pricing updated on Monday. And of course, we would never go short-term bridge, but bridge had the highest leverage. It was 75% at 9.2% interest rate. And it was just crazy. It just didn't make sense. I didn't look to the left side of the column. It was like, this is a market for long-term debt only. Long-term was 5.5. And then I looked at also seller finance and looked at the assumption, because the loan is assumable, but it has defeasance. It has a defeasance clause in it. I have to look at that because I won't be able to get any supplemental income if I assume the loan. It depends on if rates are higher, then yeah, because defeasance cost is low, rates are higher, rates are lower, defeasance is more. So it looks like we're going to go with the permanent financing. The LTV right now that they've given us is 60% at 5.5. That was a quote that came over Monday, wherever the 10-year was at the time, it was based off of that. So that's kind of what we're looking at now for future leverage. Who knows where it will be at in April. Yeah. But I do know that assumption rate stays the same. The LTV on that assumption is 63% of the 10,500,000 purchase. So it's either between the assumption and suck it up for the defeasance clause or go with the permanent financing. That's kind of where we are.
What's the price per unit on the new one?
67, somewhere around there, 67.
Interesting. Gino.
Yeah, this one is about maybe 630,000 CapEx.
Yeah.
Jake wants me to wrap this thing up, so I don't even know where to wrap this thing up. I can start out.
I can start with Quan's
story of work, being in Jersey, getting shot up. A couple of worst things in his life, best things in his life would probably be the worst things in my life. Getting shot 5 times. Now he has the notoriety.
Said better and better, Gino. He said better and better.
He said he has the notoriety of saying, "I survived that," and so did 50 Cent. So I guess you could put Fuquan and 50 Cent in the same sentence. That's pretty cool, right? I think
more alliterations.
Fuquan and 50 with five bullet holes. I guess that, yeah, that is a good alliteration, Jake. And in the second part, Stenziano, of losing $2 million. And I think the moral to the story, honestly, is where someone sees a problem or a massive problem. I think Fuquan saw these as massive opportunities. You know, when you look at something in a different way, in a different light, and you're looking at it outside the box, or you're taking back, you have time to reflect upon it, you can learn from those mistakes. A lot of us would become victims and go down that rabbit hole and say, well, I got shot five times. It wasn't my fault. Well, and you can sit there and lose those 2 years, or you can lose the $2 million and say, hey, it wasn't my fault. It was the market. But what he did is Fuquan looked internally. He reassessed it. He saw the massive problems that he made and what were those opportunities that came out of those problems. And then ultimately having his son keep telling him what to do as far as becoming the bank, as far as thinking bigger. Those are things that are awesome because some of us may say to themselves, well, what does an 18-year-old know? Well, every now and again, you should open up and listen to everyone, and everyone has something objective, intelligent to say. And you just think, you know, you hear that person and they're actually looking at it from a different perspective. Because when you're an expert, you may be locked in sometimes. You may not be able to think outside the box, but when you hear those things, it can be life-changing. So, I mean, I think it's an awesome story. I think Fuquan coming through it and actually ending up in multifamily really is a long-term mindset. Now actually building deals and stacking deals and not the ones and the twos, but the 80 units, the 100 units. Congratulations. See, it's been an amazing story, amazing journey.
Yeah, the obstacle is the way. Run towards fires instead of away from them.
And Gino, he's absolutely right because you're a heightened man with that jacket on, okay? You're in state right now, and you didn't want to do it, but you did, and you raised your game today. So keep that up. Gang, as always, we believe in buying deals for the long term. Think in decades. I'm Jake. He's the G-Daddy. We make it happen. We'll see you next time.